to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, our guests are Diana Glassman and Roberta Teller, together for 33 years. Diana is originally from Manhattan. As a kid, playing ball was a passion and a savior for her. Her other passions are writing, singing, and traveling. Diana became an activist as a young person and was involved in the civil rights movement, the LGBT movement, and the women's movement. She also had a business called Diana's Conscious Catering. Welcome, Diana.
Hi there. How are you? Nice to be here.
Roberta was born in Brooklyn and raised in Queens, New York. Some 50 years after leaving the Big Apple, Roberta continues to grow up in California. It has been here in this golden state that she was able to shed the shackles of conformity, unnamed norms and expectations, and to truly find her creative and most authentic self, yet always retaining that New York state of mind. In her working years, she was a principal, teacher, trainer, and taught at JFK University and in an evangelical Christian college in Oakland. They had no idea she was a lefty Jewish lesbian. Welcome, Roberta.
Hey, thank you. A real pleasure to be here.
We're so happy to have you here and Diana as well.
We are really looking forward to hearing and speaking with Diana and Roberta in more detail and learning about their lives. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member, our engineer, Greg Maralia.
I'd love to change the world.
This is Greg Maralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of June 2nd, 2024. Most people have pretty fond memories of attending story hours, programming, or exploring the shelves of their local library. But in Donnelly, Idaho, something entirely different is about to happen. The change is because of House Bill 710, or what's known as the, quote, library porn bill, end quote, which says anyone can use the library if a child is exposed to mature or age-appropriate material, and such material must be moved to an adults-only section away from children. The bill says that, quote, obscene content will be judged by the average person, applying contemporary community standards, end quote. And the bill also seems to target queer people. According to Boise State Public Radio, many of the books supporters of the bill cite as examples of inappropriate material have LGBTQ+ themes or are used as sex education. Opponents of the bill, which passed last month, said it could prove onerous on small libraries, but supporters of the bill brushed off those arguments. Donnelly Library says it's just too small to have an adult-only section with enough separation from kids. The Donnelly Library is only 1,024 square feet in size. The library announced that in order to comply with the legislation, it will be transitioning the library to an adult-only library as of July 1st. Children in the library's paid program whose parents signed a waiver can get access to the library's collection. Otherwise, minors will not be permitted in the library or to even use the restroom there. Idaho's Governor Brad Little vetoed a similar bill back in 2023 and said that the policy would have, quote, unintended consequences for Idaho libraries and their patrons, end quote. But he told Boise State Public Radio that he signed this iteration of the bill because, quote, it lowered the mandatory fine, end quote. And in contrast to Idaho, the state of Minnesota has banned book bans. On May 17th, Governor Tim Walz signed legislation that stops libraries in the state from removing books, quote, based solely on a viewpoint, content, message, idea, or opinion conveyed, end quote. To that end, House Bill 3782 mandates library collections be managed by a licensed library media specialist. That's an individual with a master's degree in library sciences or library and information sciences, and not a political body like an elected school board. Minnesota and 41 other states have experienced an epic rise in book bans in recent years, coinciding with the culture wars of the Make America Great Again movement and the proliferation of far-right conservative online activist groups like Moms for Liberty. According to PEN America, 4,349 book bans occurred in the first half of the 2023-2024 school year, the majority targeting books with LGBTQ plus content, a number shattering previous records. The free speech advocacy group says approximately 86% of all book bans in the United States have occurred in school districts with a local chapter of an anti-LGBTQ plus group, including groups such as Moms for Liberty, Citizens Defending Freedom, and Parents' Rights in Education. While Minnesota's new law addresses the question of school boards and other political bodies banning books based on ideology, parents or guardians in Minnesota may still request a content challenge to library books. And here in California, a ballot measure to restrict the rights of transgender youth won't be appearing on this November's ballot. The news came ahead of a legislative hearing on a state bill that would ban the outing of transgender public school students. The Bay Area Reporter said that Protect Kids California was gathering signatures for a ballot measure that would have banned transgender minors from receiving gender-affirming care, banned transgender girls from competing in female competitive sports and accessing locker rooms, and required public schools to disclose students' gender identities to parents if they say they are different than their sex at birth. California's State Assembly is considering Assembly Bill 1955, known as the Safety Act. If passed, it would ban the forced outing of transgender students in the state by public school officials unless they determine doing so is in the best interest of the child. If enacted into state law, it would supersede any such policies adopted by school districts and make them null and void. And here locally, Outwatch is hosting a Pride Film Festival on Saturday, June 8th at the Rialto Cinemas in Sebastopol. This year's film festival includes three different features. You can learn more and get tickets at rialtocinemas.com. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. I love to change the world,
but I don't. And if you just joined us, we are talking with Diana Glassman and Roberta Teller, two phenomenal women together for 33 years. So, Diana, let's start with you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about growing up in New York? How was it when you were young?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, New York was a different place back then. You know, I was born in the mid-40s. And so growing up, I grew up in the 50s. Growing up in the 50s, you know, the 50s were a very conservative time politically. I was a real tomboy. You know, I grew up in a small family. I had an older brother, a mother, and a father. And I was just a real tomboy and not a conventional kind of girly girl, which my mother really wanted me to be. She would say to me, why don't you go and play with all the girls? You know, play with the girls. All your friends are boys, you know? But I wanted to play with the boys because they had more fun. We had played punch ball. We played all these New York City ball games, which is what I was into. I wasn't into dolls and carriages.
What is punch ball?
Oh, punch ball. You get a little Spalding ball, a little rubber ball. You throw it up in the air and you punch it. And it goes far, hopefully. You know, hopefully you hit the wall on the other end of the building.
Is it a game that you play with yourself?
No. You play with other people. I played with the boys, the boys in the courtyard. None of the girls played it except for me.
It's a team game.
Well, it can be. Yeah. I mean, you choose up sides and, you know, whoever hit. It can be a team game, but it can also just be you play it. So that's punch ball. Stick ball, I didn't really play. Anyway, those are New York City games. There's a game called Off the Point where there's steps and you take the same Spalding ball and you pop it off the edge of the steps and it goes far and people catch it. Anyway, that's the kind of games I grew up playing.
So you were in the streets, right? That's what we see on TV. You guys played in the streets?
Well, we had a courtyard. You know, I grew up in this, it was a big six-story brick building and it had four entrances and around the entrances was this little courtyard. And so we kids used to play in the courtyard. You know, we had little bases. We'd run around the bases. The bases were little sewer things, you know, and we improvised. You know, we were New York City street kids, and so we played as much as we
could. Yeah, I'm curious what your mom did when you were out there all the time with the boys.
Ayanna, come up for dinner. You know? Oh, no, I'm just stay down longer. I want to play, you know. She wanted me to play with the girls, but, you know, she couldn't force me to play with the girls. I wasn't into it. So, because the girls didn't have fun, you know, they basically, like I said, you know, had dolls and carriages, and I didn't want to do that.
Very interesting. What about you, Roberta? You grew up also in New York. What was your childhood like? Was it like Diana's?
No. I was born in Brooklyn, but moved to Queens when I was 6 years old. Where we moved was a place called Douglaston, which is right on the tip of Queens, but it was actually the beginning of Long Island. It was very, very rural at that time. And so I grew up in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. It was garden apartments. And we had a court in front of our house, a courtyard, and we played. It was really fun. It was really fun. And especially in the summertime, all the kids would be out in the courtyard and we'd be playing hide and go seek and tag and stoop ball, which I think is what you were talking about.
Always.
And in the winter times, in the back of our house, it was hilly, and we'd take the sleds out and we'd go sledding down the hills. And I would say I grew up in a bubble. You know, it was Jewish. I think we had one Asian family that lived up the street from us, and they owned the laundry that was in the shopping center down the hill. We had maybe one non-Jewish family that lives in the community. My world was very small, and it honestly wasn't until I went to high school, I had to take two buses to get to high school, when I realized that the whole world wasn't Jewish. I realized that my fellow classmates, most of them, came from families where their parents were divorced. And I think that was where I first began to see and interact with children of color.
Wow. How was that for you? I mean, that's the wide awakening.
It was wow. And it took a while for the wow to seep in. But I think actually it was a really good wow, because it prepared me for, I don't know, it was an entryway, really. Because when I went to college, I became a teacher, and my work was never in white Jewish communities. It was always in predominantly Latino and African-American communities. And it was a good stepping stone for me, actually.
Interesting.
I fit right in. I had such a sense of belonging. So interestingly enough, most of the staff was Jewish, but the kids were not. And I fell in love with my kids. When I took my first teaching job, here's a good example. I was assigned to the school, PS116 in Bushwick, New York. And when I got assigned to the school, my father, who was a very kind, gentle, loving man, insisted that he come to the school with me, not on the first day of school, but to go visit the school at first. And I mean, it was kind of shocking to me because he was very kind of pulled back from my life. But we went, and he came into the building with me. He met the principal, Mr. Cash, who was a nice Jewish man from Long Island. And he introduced himself. They had this kind of camaraderie. And my father asked Mr. Cash to promise to take good care of me in the school, which he did, but he didn't really need to, because I really was able to take quite good care of myself. But it just sort of gives you an indication of really how protective my world was within my family, and yet how I so comfortably entered out of that comfort zone. I happily exited that comfort zone and entered a world that I felt like I belonged in, and I felt like I fit in, and I felt like I gave a whole lot, but I learned so much. As a matter of fact, I look back on those early teaching years, I look back and I realized that I was creating in my classroom the world that I wanted to live in. And that has been a gift that has kept on giving to me throughout my whole life. The lessons that I learned as an adult in my first teaching years.
That's a big statement that you just made, Roberta, about you created in your classroom what you wanted to see in the world. Could you kind of paint that picture for us?
I wasn't conscious of this at the time. You know, it's just looking back on it. I created a space where everyone had to be safe, where there was room for everyone, where the noisy, loud boys had to learn to be quiet, and the quiet, shy girls got the opportunity to be seen and heard. My classrooms always included, there was the academics that had to be taught, but for me, the social emotional aspects were probably even more important, or equally important, let's put it that way, where we talked about our feelings, that we used opportunities that came up in the classroom, disputes, arguments, I want this, she wants that, to solve problems collaboratively. The classroom became opportunities. I remember once, and this is like a hysterical story, but once kids would bring their lunches to school and some children's lunches were being stolen. Some of them had bites taken out of their sandwiches. I mean, it was like the weirdest thing in the world. And I could not figure out what was happening. I couldn't figure out what was happening. It was so bad once that I remember that the kids had all left the room and I came back in the classroom and I hid behind my desk, hoping that whoever was coming in and stealing, taking bites of the lunches or stealing the sandwiches, I would catch them in the act. That's how bad it was. But what happened was I never caught the culprit, but we had a conversation about that. And what the kids decided was that whoever it was that was stealing it probably needed attention and help. And it was so deep that these kids could figure out that someone was so needy and that they wanted to help this person feel good. And what they decided to do at that time was they decided to write notes to everyone in the classroom and put it into their little cubbies. They put little notes of encouragement, of kindness into everyone's cubby to support each other. Could I have come up with that? I wouldn't have come up with that. And it worked. We never found out who it was, who was stealing, but it stopped.
What a beautiful story.
Yeah, thank you for that, Roberta. So, Diana, how was it for you in school as a kid in New York?
Well, I had different phases because in elementary school, I was extremely shy and withdrawn and quiet. You know, I never said a word. In fact, one of the teachers called my mother in because she thought I was developmentally delayed. And then we had an IQ test and my IQ was actually very high. And so she was like, what's with this kid? You know, I thought she was like really not very bright, but she has a really high IQ, but she's totally withdrawn, you know, socially. And so she called my mother in. Of course, my mother had no explanation for it. There was an explanation, you know, the kind of dysfunction in my family of origin, but, you know, my mother, of course, didn't go there. Okay, so that was elementary school. I had a teacher named Miss Smith who kind of took me under her wing. And we had to do this thing called show and tell, where you had to get up and tell something that your family did over the weekend or whatever, something. And so I would never raise my hand, of course. So Miss Smith would go, Diana, how about you? You know, what did you do this weekend? No response. Well, Diana, what do you like to do? I like to ride my bike. I like to play ball. I couldn't do that in class. So she said, well, what else? Do you dance? Do you sing? So I said, sing, because I love to sing. She asked me what I like to sing. There were two songs, Over the Rainbow and Home on the Range. That was the other song I love to sing. And so since I saved Over the Rainbow for the bus, I figured I'd do Home on the Range at school. So every day for show and tell, she'd go, Diana, Home on the Range? And so she'd have me get up and sing Home on the Range.
Oh.
You know, every day. And so that's how she helped me to get out of myself kind of a little bit in elementary school. In junior high, it was a whole different story. I became like a real rebel. In fact, in the yearbook that we have for junior high, every school had a yearbook. They'd give everyone a title. It's called On the Marquee. You know, we all gave each, mine was Teenage Rebel. I became this very rebellious kind of figure and I had a bunch of girlfriends and, you know, we just did all kinds of outrageous stuff.
Like what?
Oh God. Like my friend Ellen and I, she was my best friend. She and I would go to shoe stores, you know, on the main avenue there. And write about this in my memoir, you know, we try on like lots of pairs of shoes with no intention or having any money to buy any of them. We just were hassling, you know, the shoe guy, you know, and she'd say to me, oh, we want something dressier to go with that plum dress mother got us from B. Altman. They believe we were sisters, you know, no plum dress from B. Altman's, you know. And so the guy would bring stuff out and then we'd leave and we'd be hysterical laughing. You know, we just used to harass people, you know, with like our little teenage anger stuff, you know.
How did you become so quiet to becoming this rebel? What happened? Was it hormones or what?
Probably hormones. That's all I can say, because there was a switch in seventh grade. You know, I was kind of the leader of my little group. The only explanation I have is hormones.
Did you like that person you were becoming?
Oh, yeah. Much better than the little shy girl whom I can't say I liked. I was just very hidden. Yeah, I didn't have very much self-esteem, you know, when I was really young.
I'm wondering, our listeners might be thinking the same thing, wondering about you, Diana. It takes a lot of courage and initiative to play ball. And I can't see you being this little hidden nothing playing ball. I see you as exuberant.
I was in the courtyard. I had two lives.
So in the courtyard, you were exuberant. When you went to the classroom, you were totally shut down.
Yeah.
Now, did you have any of the boys that you played with go to school with you?
No, no.
Oh, because they would have called you out on that, wouldn't they have?
Oh. Richie? Yeah, probably he would have. I don't know.
Your rebellion was a great thing because it led you into all your activism.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And it led me to myself.
Say more.
Well, you know, when I was a shy little girl, I was very hidden. I didn't know who I was. I was very shut down, you know, and it was because there was family violence in my family. You know, my father was a violent man and he beat my brother very badly and I was afraid of him. And so, you know, that really shut me down. I mean, that's why I was so shut down, I think, because of family violence. And then something happened to change me in junior high, which, you know, also probably thinking about it historically, my brother, who was almost 6 years older than I was, he's gone now. He passed away a couple of years ago. But, you know, he was getting probably at that point too big for my father to beat. So maybe that changed by the time I was in junior high. So I was 14. Yeah. So my brother was 18. Yeah. So he wasn't being beaten anymore. That was a big change in my family and enabled me to find my own voice more, because I wasn't hiding all the time behind my mother, you know.
So while you're at it, may as well tell us about your focus going into college, being an activist and all of that. Yeah, tell us.
My first march, I remember, was a Ban the Bomb march. I was 14 years old. I don't know how I found out about it, but I went down somewhere in New York and marched with people who were significantly older than I was. And I went by myself. And that was kind of the beginning of what I call my activism. You know, I just always had a bent in that direction, or ever since I was 14. It was 14 that I started to write. I started to become a writer as well. So 14 was a changing point for me. I don't know why or how, it just was. And so, yeah, I just had a natural bent toward being an activist, toward injustice, you know, and I saw the way Black people were treated in our country as a very unjust thing, and anything that was unjust, I, you know, then I became an anti-war activist, you know, against the war in Vietnam. I mean, that was a few years later. There was something in me that I don't know how or where it came from. I guess to a degree, my father had been a communist when he was a young man and had been a political activist. And when he married my mom kind of made him quit the Communist Party. My mom was much more conservative and conventional. And so he did, because, you know, to please her. But I got that. I also got it from my brother. You know, we were both just very concerned with social justice.
It's interesting, though, to me that you, when your brother stopped getting beaten by your dad, you were about 13, 14. And that's when you found your activism. You went to your first protest. You started marching for injustice. Like, you were marching for someone, maybe you wish someone had marched for you when you were growing up and being oppressed, you know?
Totally, totally.
So that is just beautiful.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful.
There's no doubt about that. I wish there had been someone to protect me, and there wasn't really.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to affect other people. That's why I became a social worker, really, you know.
A social worker?
Yeah, I was a social worker for many years. Yeah.
There's so many hats. Both of you, Diana and Roberta, you guys wear so many hats.
Yeah, I got MSW in 1979. I went to social work school at Stony Brook on Long Island from 77 to 79. Got my MSW and became a social worker. Yeah, I mean, I did that for many years.
Wow, did not know that about you.
So when you both left New York and came to California, so tell us about that. Before we go into our break,
I first came to San Francisco in 1967. The summer of 67 was called at the time the Summer of Love. I don't know if either of you remember that, but my brother, whom I was very close with, and our friend Myra, who wasn't really our friend at the time, but we wanted to get a driver. Neither one of us knew how to drive a car. We grew up in Manhattan. Our family didn't have a car. So we got this person, Myra, who Roger worked with, and she drove the car cross country. And we came out to California. And Raj went home and Myra and I went on to San Francisco. And I just fell in love with San Francisco. I remember standing on the streets and saying, wow, this place is so beautiful. I could never afford to live here. You know, it seemed out of my class. You know, I came from a working class kind of background and I just didn't have money or think that. It just seemed like it was a very rich place. That's how San Francisco felt to me. I mean, obviously it wasn't completely, but that's what I saw, you know. And then years later, I moved here. You know, I moved to San Francisco.
That's beautiful. I wish we had more time to get into that, but we do have to take our music break right now. And we want to get Roberta in on the conversation as well. So Roberta, when we come back from our music break, we're going to start talking with you about your years going to college, just like Diana talked a little bit about, okay? But for now, you all brought a song and we'd like you to introduce the song. Roberta, why don't you go ahead and talk about the song and why you brought it today? What does it mean to you both?
Well, the song is Betcha by Golly Wow. We like the Aaron Neville version of the song. And I think the words just speak to, betcha by golly wow, you're the one that I've been waiting for.
It was our song.
Wow, you just gave me chills.
I love that.
No, we used to dance to it. You know, we'd play Aaron Neville, betcha by golly wow, and we'd dance to it. It was kind of our song.
That's beautiful. We're going to learn more about you as a couple in the next segment as well. Like, how old were you when you met? And what's the 33 years been like? And what are your secrets to staying together? After our music break. So everybody, please enjoy Betcha by Golly Wow. Aaron Neville is singing, and we will see you on the other side. And welcome back to Living Proof. And we are talking with Diana Glassman and Roberta Teller. And we have some questions for you, Roberta.
Right on. We left off with Diana talking about coming to California. So how did you make the big move, Roberta, from New York to here? Or did you do something in between?
Well, my move to California happened in, let's see, in the summer of 1973. I was married to Ken.
Oh.
And Ken and I decided it was a summer vacation to take a trip to, actually, we're going to Colorado. And at that time, we had friends named Cindy and Howard who were at that time taking a trip to California. And the idea was at that time that we would meet somewhere in Colorado. That was the plan. So Kenny and I drive cross country and we get to Colorado and we call Cindy and Howard and we say, hey, we're here, come on, meet us. And they were actually in Berkeley, and then they said, oh no, we're having such a good time here, you come to Berkeley, we have a place for you to stay. So, you know, we're what, in our 20s, we said of course, got back in the car and we drove to Berkeley, and we had a really fun, wonderful time, met great people. And Kenny, me and Howard all decided in the week or two we were there that they wanted to move to California. And I said, no, I have my job, I have my family, and that was it. And so Cindy and Howard drove back separately, and Kenny and I did our trip cross country. And Kenny and I got to the George Washington Bridge at 12 o'clock at night, where there was stop and go traffic, 12 o'clock at night. This is after driving, you know, 60 miles an hour the whole way, stop and go. And okay, so we're sitting there, I'm listening to the radio, and on the radio comes an announcement that there's a sniper shooting at cars on the Cross Bronx Expressway. Now this is 12 o'clock at night. Of course, we were taking the Cross Bronx Expressway. I can't believe this, traffic, a sniper. I said, yes, let's move to California. And 3 weeks later, we were in the U-Haul and we drove cross country. And that was it. So that's how I got here. And we arrived in October of 1973. No job, no income. I think we had an apartment. That was it.
So your friends Cindy and Howard were already in Berkeley. I had already moved permanently to Berkeley.
We all moved together. We drove cross country together in a caravan.
Got it.
We towed a car. We had the cat and the dog, and we just did it.
Okay, so how long did that last? Because we want to know your coming out stories. You're in San Francisco, so with Ken.
Well, what can I say? So I left Kenny a few months after I got to California. I left him in April of 74. And then there was a couple of, you know, this was the 70s. It was my sex, drugs, and rock and roll time. And so there was some of that going on, a little of this, a little bit of that. There was another husband. And then there was graduate school. And I decided to go to John F. Kennedy University. I decided to enter their clinical holistic health program. And I had to write a personal paper. And in that paper, they asked for a statement of why I wanted to be in this program. And I said, famous last words, for my personal growth. Well, I got my personal growth on June 9th, 1984. It was the first night of school, and I was standing outside waiting for the class that was going on to finish and the new group of people to enter the classroom. And I looked at this woman and I went, wow. And she looked at me and she said, you know, you look like the first woman I was ever with. And I went, wow. And 3 months later, I left husband number two and moved in with Micah, not Diana, but that was-
She hadn't met me yet.
I hadn't met Diana yet, but that was the beginning. And then shortly after Micah and my relationship ended, I went to Shinoa. I don't know if you remember Shinoa Retreat Center in Philo. I went there for Labor Day weekend, 1990. And actually, should I tell the whole story?
Oh, no.
but to make a long story short, that's where we met. September of 1990, Labor Day weekend. And we've been together ever since.
Oh.
And the story of how we met there is
funny.
Sort of funny, yes.
Maybe Diana say the funny part.
Yeah.
All right. So there we were. There were little cabins there. I was there with my friend Marta, my good friend. She was not a lover. And Roberta was there with her friend Jim, a gay man. We shared like this cabin with a wall separating us. Marta and I got there like around midnight, got there late, and we were moving the beds apart so we didn't have to sleep like right next to each other. Roberta heard us from, you know, the walls were very thin. Roberta was like, what's going on? These people, they're moving their beds together. And she was like mad, you know, angry that we were at midnight moving beds together.
Because I was thinking I'm going to have to listen to them all night long.
Do it all night long. Okay. But we were really moving them apart. Okay. So the next morning we get up and I see Roberta on the deck of the cabin. And I guess she was meditating. But I thought she was just a very unfriendly woman. Oh, hi, neighbor. How are you? You know, nothing. So I walked away. I said, wow, who's that unfriendly person? Then later on, I saw my friend Marta was talking to Roberta's roommate, Jim, whom I thought was her boyfriend at the time. And they really hit it off. And so we all decided to have breakfast together. So we're at the breakfast table and I'm still not really liking Roberta. Like she's like very unfriendly and very into her coffee. I don't like the coffee here. Where's, you know, I want this coffee. You know, Roberta, she's a real coffee person. So, and I wasn't. So anyhow, at some point started to talk at the table and we realized we're both from New York and we were both Jewish and we both were like the same age kind of, and we just hit it off. All of a sudden I like, whoa, I really like this woman, Roberta. You know, I was sort of shocked. And then her friend, Jim, started to talk about gay rights marches, and it became apparent that he was gay. He was a gay man. They weren't together. They weren't married. I thought they were married or, you know, just lovers. But no, in fact, Jim was gay. And so I thought, oh, well, what about her? You know, and I took a second look at her. And anyway, we just hit it off on Labor Day weekend of 1990. We started to talk and we realized we really liked each other. This person who I looked at and thought was so unfriendly and didn't like, all of a sudden, ooh, it changed. You know, I really liked her and I wanted to see her again. So that was where we met. And then we did have a date. It took a while because you were in Hawaii, right? I was with another woman. Whoops, I forgot. And so I didn't want to start anything with Roberta because I wanted to see where it was going to go with this other woman. And finally, eventually, this other woman and I, whose name I will not mention, broke up around Thanksgiving. And so I called my friend Mart. I said, Mart, I really want to call that woman from Shinoa, Roberta, but I don't know. She probably won't even remember me. It's been a couple of months. So Mart says, call her, Deej, call her. She'll remember you. She liked you. So I called Roberta. And we got together shortly after that.
The rest is history.
Yeah, she fell in love with my dogs before she fell in love with me.
So no more kins after that, huh? For those 2 months. you didn't backpedal, Roberta.
No, that was it. We dove.
You were thinking about Diana, huh?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Were you waiting for her to call you? Did you know why she didn't call you for a couple months?
I didn't call her either.
Yeah, she didn't call me.
Right.
No, and well, what Diana didn't tell you is that I met two women that weekend. One of them was Diana, and one was a woman who lived like three blocks from my house. So we had this little thing going on, but I wasn't really liking her. And it just so happened right around the time Diana called me, it was actually that weekend.
Right after Thanksgiving.
Right that time when she called me, like I really wasn't interested in this other woman. So the timing was just, it was like perfect. And Yes, I did remember her.
Oh, what a sweet story. Wow. Now it's 33 years later.
So is it 34 this coming September in 2024? It'll be 34 years. Yikes.
Wow.
It's a long time. Before we get into your secrets of, you know, long-term relationships, because you must have some secrets, I'm very curious. Roberta, you told us, like, you were married to men, so you didn't really know about being with women. You weren't with a woman till after you'd been married and all that stuff. But Diana.
I didn't say that. Well, I had been interested. You know, it was the 60s and the 70s. And so there was lots of experimentation. And I had been interested in women and had a few little things while I was married. I mean, it was an open thing. It was open. I mean, I was... Okay, so we had these friends, and I wound up sleeping with her.
What did the two men do?
The funny story is, nights together, you know, doing what you did in the 60s and 70s, and getting high and hanging out, and, you know, eventually you'd fall asleep. Well, it was the night before I was leaving for California. And we were together with this couple, and the guys fell asleep. She and I looked at each other, and we said, if not now, when? That was my going away present, going to California.
Interesting. Well, what about you, Diana, and coming out? When did you know?
Oh, when did I know? Always. I mean, you know, I was in love with my best friend from high school, totally in love. We recently reconnected, by the way, this woman, Debbie and I. You know, we did something in Amsterdam, actually, but it never went to fruition because that was like 1964, and you didn't really come out in 1964. I mean, it was really hard. Actually, I did come out in 66 because I wanted to be with Debbie, you know, but that just didn't pan out in that way. And so there was this woman named Betty, and she was a lesbian, and she and I got together in 1966. But it wasn't like a real love connection for me. You know, I just did it because I really was anxious to come out, to be with a woman, to see what that was like. So it wasn't great because, like I said, I didn't have a real strong emotional connection with her. Then in 67, the famous summer of 67, that I told you about when I went cross country with my brother and this woman, Myra. Myra was a lesbian. I mean, I totally fell in love with her, and we were together for a while. It didn't pan out into a long-term relationship because she was living with another woman at the time. And so it was very conflictual for her and for me, you know, and I still was relating to men at the time also. In a way, I was relieved that she didn't want to live with me because I didn't know if I could commit to being a lesbian, to being with a woman. Anyway, but I did love her, and she and I stayed friends over the years. She passed a couple of years ago, and we're still close. So Myra and I were together for about a year and a half. And I don't know, who was I with after that? I can't even remember. Everyone. I was with a lot of women. You know, there was a lot of sleeping around in the women's community, and I took of that. Yeah. Oh, Carol, I had a committed relationship from 77 to 79 with a woman named Carol. She's passed also. Wow. Anyway, so that's how I came out with Betty Peterson, who wasn't really the love of my life, but it was something that brewing within me and I wanted to experience. But then I really fell in love with Myra, my second girlfriend.
So you both are coming out, and Roberta, you talked about your strict family being tight and protective. And Diana, you had your dad who was strict and all of that. So were you able to talk to them about your coming out and who you were, and how did they accept you or not?
So I told my brother immediately when I first was with Betty Peterson. I told him what I was doing, and he told me years later that his reaction was he was happy because he always felt that he was the identified patient in our family. And now I was the one who was going to be looked down upon. You know? So he was like, whoa, okay, you know.
But your parents?
My father pretty much kicked me out of the house. You know, I mean, I wasn't living with them at the time, but I told him, and he was just like furious. And he said, get out of here. You know, we did reconcile. I don't know how long afterwards, but yeah, that was his first response. And my mother's response, you know, she thought it was a phase and it's okay. You know, I don't think she was terribly upset about it. You know, maybe my father took on that role of being the one with the, you know, I'm sure she wasn't happy about it. You know, for sure she wasn't happy, but my father was furious, so.
But you didn't let it stop you.
Oh, no way. My father wasn't going to stop. No one was going to stop me. I mean, that was my path. That was, you know, what I wanted. So
good for you.
What about you, Roberta, coming out with your family?
So in 1984, when I left husband number two, Bob, it took me a few months. I moved in with a friend of mine. And a few months after I moved out, I had a conversation with my mother, and I decided I needed to tell her. So I told her that I had left Bob because I fell for this woman. It was really hard, really uncomfortable. And the first thing she said to me was, it's all about her. She said to me, well, did I do anything wrong? Is it my fault? And I told her, no, it wasn't her fault. I don't even remember what else I said. But what I do remember her saying to me was, don't tell your father, it will kill him. So fast forward 9 years. My relationship with Mike is over. Diana and I are living together. We've been living together for a number of years at that point. I get a phone call from my mother, and the first thing she says to me is, your father knows. And I know exactly what she's saying. And I said, well, how did this happen? She said, it wasn't in a good way. So they obviously had a fight or disagreement or whatever, and she threw it at him. The irony is he knew because he had figured it out years ago. So this tells you about my family. So she knew, didn't want me to tell him because it would kill him. And he didn't tell her because he didn't think she could handle it. So anyway, so I'm on this conversation with my mother. And I said, okay, put daddy on right now. Because I knew if I didn't talk to him about it in this moment, another 9 years would go by. So my father gets on the phone and he says, hi, so how's the weather? And I'm going, okay, here we go. So I said, Dad, I know you know. And he starts to laugh. And then he tells me, yeah, he said, I figured it out a long time ago and I didn't want to tell your mother. And then he says to me, look, Roberta, he says, you're my daughter and I love you no matter what.
Oh.
And it was such a beautiful moment. And it made me so, so sad because 9 years had gone by without me being my true self to my father and not, you know, sharing my life with him and them. So that was a hard lesson. One of the funny stories is, you know, years later, my father was trying to sort this out and he had a conversation with the two of us.
No, it was with me. He said, well, you know, I don't know. What should I call you?
What should I tell people?
You know, he said, I can't say you're my niece because I don't have a son.
He was trying to figure out how to name her. To make her and a member of the family, I think without calling you his daughter-in-law.
Right. Oh, he said, I can't call you my daughter-in-law. That's right.
I can't call you my
daughter-in-law. I don't know. Anyway, he just, yeah.
But he was, it was sweet, you know. He was an older man. He was just trying to sort it out. But he wanted to make you a member of the family.
Yeah, totally. He was very accepting. I loved each other. I loved her dad, man, and he loved me, you know. He was a sweet guy. I loved him.
Yeah. But it was sad, you know, sad that I didn't feel comfortable. None of us felt comfortable talking to each other.
Talking about it. Yeah.
I wonder what we could do about that. I mean, because I hear so many stories like that, Roberta, that the parents knew, but they're waiting for the kids to tell them. And it's just like all that time lost and wasted for you to just show up as you are, you know? I wish we could do something about that because that happens now in 2024, you know?
Don't you think it's changed some with the gay rights movement? I mean, and more acceptance. I think it has changed some, certainly.
It's weird. Yeah, it has changed, but we still hear those same stories and people are still in the closet for whatever reason. They are afraid still because kids are still getting bullies in schools. Yeah, and colleges and in the workplace. For being LGBTQ++, you know?
It's that time that we have to say goodbye. And before we do that, we always like to ask our guests for words of wisdom. So, both of you, you've been together 33 years. How did you make it work? How are you making it work? What can you give our listeners if they want to know the secret? What do you have to say about it?
One thing I would say is to be honest with each other, to not keep secrets, to put things on the table, you know, to learn to accept each other and accept each other's differences too, because Roberta and I certainly have differences on lots of levels. you know, we have a lot of similarities too. And I think some of the similarities have helped to keep us together. You know, the both being from New York, both being Jewish, both being around the same age, you know, both having similar class backgrounds, a little different, but pretty much similar. You know, I think all that has helped to keep us together, would you say? You know, but I think one thing that has really helped our relationship and helped to keep us together is laughter. We both love to laugh and we have kind of similar senses of humor. And we sometimes we just get hysterical together, you know, and that's like a wonderful gift, a wonderful healing gift. You know, before I met Roberta, it's just a little sidebar. You know, I was single and I had been single for a bunch of years, for like 8 years. And I knew I wanted to be with someone. And I put out in my mind, okay, I want to meet? What do I want? I said, okay, I want her to be around my age. I'd like her to be from New York. I'd like her to be Jewish. I'd like her to have like a similar class background, educational background, similar money thing, except maybe she could have a little more than I do. And I want us to be able to laugh together. And I want her to have been in therapy. I want her to have some insight into her family dynamics and her stuff, you know? So those are all the things I asked for. And then shortly after that, I met you.
Sweet.
What about you, Roberta? Words of wisdom.
I would say, you know, very much the same. I think laughter. I think also differences can arise so easily and so fast. And one thing that I think that helps me is that when we touch, just to touch, even if a rough, difficult time, touching, feeling her, having her touch me, I think helps really bridge some of the gaps that are widening. That's something that I've learned. And another piece that I'm working on right now is to really remember that what's most important to me as a human being is to be open-hearted, and especially towards myself and towards Diana. Keep my heart as open as I possibly can, and to remember how much loving kindness I feel for myself, and I also feel for her.
Oh, that's beautiful. Both of you. Thank you so much for being on our show this month, and happy Pride to you.
Happy Pride. And thank you. Really. I mean, my mom, I was just smiling the whole time listening to your story. So thank you. Thank you.
And in honor of Pride, we would like to offer this wonderful poem written by our one and only Diana Grayer. It is called Let Us Walk Together.
Let us walk together and talk. Let us go into the redwoods and surround ourselves with the beautiful sounds of nature and embrace the beautiful blessings from Mother Earth. In this world of nature, we both can be free, having no pressure to be anyone or anything but ourselves. This place is where our hearts are open and accepting. We can peacefully breathe. Breathe in the fresh air and the different smells of nature. Every step is relaxing and calming.
Let us walk together, side by side, with awareness of each other, respectful of each other, appreciating our differences and our humanness, and the comfort we feel with one another. How amazing is this moment! Thank you for obliging me on this most pleasurable journey.
Let us walk together in peace. I hope you feel there's no need to fear me, as I don't need to fear you. Even in our differences and similarities, we can coexist and even enjoy each other when we let ourselves. Here, no one is watching but the spirits of nature and the highest source of us all.
Let us walk together as we admire each other. Here, we can learn about each other. In our learning, we can share moments of intrigue and laughter. We become the model for all human beings. A gentle walk together in nature can change perspectives, thoughts, feelings, stereotypes, and assumptions. There's no hate here. Centuries of prayers have been spoken for true humanity to exist.
So let us walk together. with those we differ from and those we have accused without evidence. We must eliminate hatred from our hearts. We have to end the trend of blatant and unabashed hatred, violence, abuse, the imbalance of equity and justice, and all the isms. Hatred is misguided and is blinding of the true nature of things. This trend makes us ponder the human condition and the world we inhabit. I ask myself daily, why does hatred persist when we can choose love?
Let us walk together, guided by love. You are you and I am me. How can I be different from who I am? How can you be different from who you are? Imagine if we all walk together with open hearts.
No more wars.
No violence.
No racism.
No anti-Semitism.
No misogyny.
No inequity.
No injustice.
No ethnic cleansing.
No homophobia.
Or transphobia.
Or gender phobia. No hatred of any kind. This is a possible dream. It starts by you saying to someone, let us walk together. May you be safe on your journey ahead of all the celebrations of Pride this month, and ask someone to go for a walk into the woods.
Hey, Diana, want to go on a walk?
Let's walk together, Sheridan.
It's time to say goodbye, and we just want to remind everybody, just like Roberta and Diana, you too can be living proof that being visible and vibrant and living your authentic lives, you can make this world a better world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we will be back next month. Until then,
good night.
I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop me now. And you can.
For Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Beale Street Caravan is next.